For the week of July 26, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 504, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at Dead.net, I'm Michael Giltz.
I have no idea what you're... Every week, it's some... What is Dead.net?
You are not a Grateful Dead head?
I've listened to their music from time to time.
Well, there you go. Jerry Garcia is being honored with a 9-day live streaming event with lots of musicians coming in. So I'm very excited for that. I'm getting my seat early. And, you know, I guess it's 9 days. So I guess they're just playing one song.
No, 9 days, you're going to make it to at least the second song, maybe even an encore.
Maybe even an encore. Yes. So one little note from last week. We don't usually say nice things about Kim Kardashian. We don't usually talk about her much at all. But, you know, when she does something good, I thought she did a great thing talking about the fact that her husband, Kanye West, lives with bipolar, has bipolar disorder, and that it affects what he does. But he's an adult, and you cannot tell functioning adults what to do or not do. You cannot control them. And people with bipolar are competent enough to speak up in court and say, no, I am in control of my decisions. They're rational enough, and yet they behave irrationally. So you get these horrible issues where someone you love is doing things that you know are harming them, but you can't stop them. I have a friend who dealt with bipolar disorder. He's literally homeless or in jail now. His whole life was destroyed by it. His family did everything they could. In fact, they did for 3 days have him committed against his will for 72 hours, which he, of course,
which is the longest you can do in this country.
It just did everything we could to help him. It breaks my heart every time I think about it. He's totally lost to us. I don't know. He went into jail a few times because he felt more comfortable there. He, you know, fake robbed a bank so that they would arrest him and put him back in jail. You know, walk into a bank, say, I want your money, and then sit there and wait for the cops to show up. Literally that intentional. So bipolar disorder is a huge problem. Kanye West has been dealing with mental health issues all his life. I think we said pretty responsibly when his whole presidential thing, I was annoyed at the media treating it as like, oh, Kanye West, like it was a serious thing, A, or B, like it was a fun circus to talk about. I'm like, this guy's not well. Stop getting clickbaits off this. And it's not a serious run for president. I mean, he's a wealthy man. If he decided to run properly, yeah, he could have an impact. But he was just, you know, he hadn't really filed anywhere except one state where you could just give him some cash to register. He wasn't getting on the ballot in states. Even to be a write-in candidate, you have to get on the ballot or qualify in certain ways. So it was a joke. Or as I should say, it was not something that the media should have treated seriously, but I saw it on all the evening news. They reported it as news like it was a serious thing. They made it, oh, Kanye West announced, what's going on? Come back after the
break. I thought for sure he was going to literally say, and here's my album. I thought it was like a way to get like,
well, he did. It wasn't necessarily cynical or a promo thing in that sense, though he did announce he was going to put out an album, but then that disappeared and Taylor Swift was the one that came out with an album. But anyway,
have you listened to the new Taylor Swift album?
I haven't.
Yeah, neither have I.
No, I will. So bipolar disorder, serious. I thought the media did a poor job. There's no way to keep the TMZs and the Entertainment Tonights of the world from not making hay on stuff like that. But the major networks and other people should be a little more responsible and recognize when someone is doing something that's either just publicity or perhaps is not well. So I appreciate her speaking out about that. It's a big problem. What a bummer way to start the show. Here's another bad way to start the show. No episode next week.
Yes, that we should kind of mention that we're off next week, but we will be back.
We're off? Is that how we put it?
Okay, Sperling, I'm off next week.
Sperling, what are you doing anyway? How come we're not having a show?
This is the trip up to the grandparents for my kids.
Oh, great. Well, I drove across country for an outdoor wedding for my brother, and yet I still managed not to miss a week.
That is true. Wow. And so how was that? A wedding during coronavirus, what's that like?
Tense. You know,
do you mean tense as in you were in a tent or tense as in it was tense?
Both. There was no tent, but then there was a tent, I guess. So tense in every possible way. Everybody has their own attitude of what's important and what you should do and what's not important. So it's a problem when you all have to get together and sort of not agree. So it was tense, but it was a lovely wedding, beautiful outdoor setting, very nicely done. It was great that my mom and I could be there. Not everyone in the family could make it there because of plane travel. They didn't want to do that. We drove, so we were able to be there and be as safe as possible, and we're very glad we did it. And we're really glad we didn't have to miss an episode of the show. What are we going to talk about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we continue our box office reports, not on what movies are grossing, but on what box offices are opening and then closing and then opening again as Hollywood continues to push new big movies farther and farther into the future. We won't see the sequel to A Quiet Place until 2021, and that's turning movie theaters into a very, very quiet place indeed. The Emmy nominations are out this week, and we'll take a first pass at what it all means. The Mandalorian for Best Drama, is that really... Did that really happen? I guess so. How come the Oscars can't figure out how to nominate popular stuff, but the Emmys can? That's what I want to know. On Inside Baseball, we'll look at the growing need for government support for the arts if they hope to see the entertainment business bounce back. We're talking cash, people, okay? Desperately needed COVID insurance and much more. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss some of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's video on demand charts, and now some box office, not a lot, but some.
I actually didn't get a lot of good news stories. I know China opened up again. It grossed about $12 million on its reopening weekend, which seemed to be older fare, but I didn't get a good breakdown of what made what. Peninsula, that's the Train to Busan 2 film from South Korea that had opened up in about four territories. I think it dropped pretty hard this week. I think it made about $7 million worldwide. Last week, it made about $21 or $20 million. Since then, I think it's made another $6 or $7 million. So that to me shows there was a pent-up demand for people to go to the movies, but there isn't a pent-up demand for people to go to the movies again and again. You have a hardcore small audience that is saying, yes, we want to do this or for the novelty of it. But week two, this movie dropped 60, 70%. I don't think that's a comment on the movie. I think it's a comment on the fact that not a lot of people are going to pull the trigger. Maybe you'll get people out opening weekend for Tenet, but maybe they're not going to go back again and again. And all the people who might have gone out for a big event movie are just going to be, I don't know. So,
well, now, okay, you said you didn't have any data.
Well, not great data.
Okay, so here's what I can tell you. Okay. And I know, Michael, you and I are reading or have read a book called Feeding the Dragon by Chris Fenton, who we hope to have on the show in the future, in the not too distant future, in fact. And we have had this year, twice, this year already. And he wrote a book called Feeding the Dragon about working in China in the motion picture business and, in fact, producing Iron Man 3.
Yep.
Well, that was one of the first big openings in China. And you want to know why Hollywood is waiting for China? Because remember when Dr. Dolittle came out here in the U.S. in January and nobody went to see it?
Yep.
Well, it was released in China again, and it earned $5.1 million over the past week in China. So that's why they're waiting for China, because you know what? They make money. And that movie, Sheep Without a Shepherd, do you remember that?
Yep.
That came in second place in China at $3.3 million. Bloodshot, the Vin Diesel movie, $2.8 million. And then Coco, I don't know whether it's Coco Chanel or Coco.
It's the Pixar film.
The Disney film. Yes, it is animated. And that came in fourth at $1.1 million. Now, let me ask you this. Did you ever think in a million years we would be doing the Chinese box office rundown?
Yes, I did. Yes, we have, because we talk about worldwide box office all the time. Dolittle grossed about $77 million in North America, meaning the U.S. and Canada. And before China, it grossed double that in the rest of the world. It grossed $151 million in other parts of the world. Now it's opened up in China. They probably hope to do a lot better than $5 million, but it tells you the lights are on. It's a new movie to them. So it made $5 million. It could have made more if people were really eager and hungry to go to the movies, but it adds to that film's total. That's why all the other exhibitors around the world are saying, we're sorry the U.S. isn't open. We're sorry that China is only semi-open and that they're limiting you to movies that are under 2 hours. But you make most of your money in the rest of the world. The U.S. is a hugely important market. It can drive the rest of the world, but you can make a lot of money opening up in Europe and Asia, especially with China back on board. So, hey, if you've got a movie you can open up, let's not wait. If we don't have product, we can't reopen, and people are ready to go back to the movies. We don't want them to lose the habit of going to the movies, which I'm not really concerned about, but that's what they're saying. Look, the lights are on. Please give us your movies.
Yeah, and it's made quite a bit of money in China thus far. I
What's
mean, it's
it?
Opening week. Sorry, Dr. Doolittle.
It made 5 million, you said.
Well, that's this past weekend. However, it had made $76.8 million before that.
Oh, previously. Oh, it's a reissue.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Most of these films in China are reissues.
Oh, okay. So I thought Doolittle was a new release there. I thought it hadn't opened up there for some reason. Yeah. So it made the same as it did in the U.S. They made about the same amount of money, about $75, $80 million in both the U.S. and China. That's why those two markets are so important. And now China's gone back again to see it and say, all right, we'll see some Robert Downey and some animals. It wasn't that good, but we'll go again. So yes, the 2/3 of the Hollywood box office can come from overseas. It's a huge part of the worldwide market, depending on the film. So, you know, we can't wait anymore for the U.S. This is they're not going to be open really till next year in the U.S. I don't see it happening because we're not going to have a solid shutdown and a solid reopening. So we're not going to have a nationwide box office. Maybe certain cities can reopen, but there's no way you're going to guarantee New York and L.A. are open for a month.
Okay, so I don't know. Do you want to talk about that now, about the delay of movies, or do you want to do
Let's do the video on demand chart. We're looking at the week of July.
We'll come back to it.
We're looking at the week of July 13th through July 19th. We're just looking at the North American charts of the most popular films on demand. These are movies that you can rent for $3 to $5. So it's not premium video on demand. It's not streaming or ad video on demand. This is just stuff you click online and go, yeah, I want to watch Trolls World Tour and I'll pay $4 to do it. The most popular film in the country right now is Trolls World Tour. At number two is The Outpost. At number three is Force of Nature. At four is Relic, which critics like a lot more than regular horror fans. And at number five is Bad Boys for Life. Now we have the bottom 10 and one new movie on this list. Invisible Man is at six. Money Plane, I think that's a new flick. That's at seven. Sonic the Hedgehog is at eight. Archive, that's also new. That's at nine. And Jumanji, the next level, is at 10. Now, Archive is a sci-fi flick that was set to open up at South by Southwest. I think it was in March, right? That's when that takes place.
Yes.
And that has a link to the Sam Rockwell film Moon. There's an artist who was involved in that movie on some level, production design or visuals or something like that. And he ended up directing and creating this film Archive. So there's some cool link to another indie film. I would have liked to have checked it out. The reviews are mixed, but friendly. And Money Plane, for some reason, this warms my heart. It's a B-movie heist flick starring the wrestler Edge, he's from Canada, Kelsey Grammer, Denise Richards, and Thomas Jane. This is just that's as B-movie as it gets. You know, talented people who've sort of fallen down or gotten lost in it. A wrestler trying to break up in, a B-movie action guy with Thomas. I mean, it's just, you know, the fact that movies like this still get made when it's not the era where a poster can sell your movie or you know you're going to make it back on VHS, it just warms my heart. I'm happy to see Money Plane happening. You have nothing to say to that, but I'll tell you.
Not really. I mean, you pretty much said it all
talking about release dates, and I think you're right. Sperling was right. Tenet, he kept telling us, that's going to come out, and it's going to come out in the rest of the world first, and that's what's happening. It's getting a staggered release worldwide. Everything old is new again, right? So it's coming out August 26th overseas, and perhaps in select cities in the U.S., on Labor Day weekend around September 3rd. So this is how it used to be for most of history. Movies would open up in one country, then go around the world, country by country.
Now, why did they do that?
Expensive to make 10,000 prints.
That's right. So they would take a print from, say, the U.S. where the film had opened and then move it over to France or to Australia. And likewise, a French film would open in France and then they'd take that print, burn subtitles into it and bring it over to the U.S.
That's right. So a staggered release date is back. Everything old is new again. Drive-ins, radio plays, staggered releases instead of day and date. Just hold on. And I suppose the Victrola will be hot soon.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that.
No.
Although actually, you know what? Vinyl is the new black. So
that's right. So what other release dates do we have? AMC delayed the reopening because Tenet is delaying its reopening.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's no reason to have. I mean, right. They aren't going to be open unless there are new movies.
Right. They want like a 10-day rehearsal before new movie opens up. They want to air out the theater, get everybody down with the new protocols, and show some reissued movies from the past, and then they'll be ready when that new movie comes up. So they want a week to 10 days before that new movie happens. So that's always been the plan, and they have to keep delaying because movies keep getting delayed. Disney has updated its Mulan. That's also expected to open overseas first, a la Tenet.
Although they don't have a date for that. Have you noticed they did not date that?
Nope, it's undated. They've also pushed back the Avatar and Star Wars films by an entire year. So some movies meant to come out in 2021, they're coming out in 2022. The ones coming out in 2022 are coming out in 2023. Paramount's done the same
thing. To which mm-hmm. James Cameron says, hey, you thought I was actually going to release a movie in 2021. Everybody knows that's not true. This movie was supposed to be out 5 years ago.
Paramount's doing the same thing. Top Gun Maverick, A Quiet Place 2, delayed until 2021. Bill and Ted 3, that's going in the opposite direction. It hits video on demand and select U.S. cinemas at the same time on Tuesday, September 1st. They said, you know what? We can't wait any longer. However, Bill and Ted 3, I suppose that can open up overseas, right?
Yes, it will open up overseas, I believe.
And Germany says, look, our movie theaters, we're not really ready to open up with 30% capacity or social distancing. We need more capacity or we just can't survive. It's not going to work otherwise. But some things are working. SAG-AFTRA members, for example, they're ready to work. Their members have approved the new contract that was up for voting consideration. And they said, yes, we are down with this. We are ready. We want to get back to work. But CES.
Now, you know what? I bet you Russell Crowe is a SAG member.
Sure.
I wouldn't be shocked if he is. And he's also in Unhinged.
Yeah.
Unhinged opened. It was supposed to open July 31st. I don't know. Maybe it's going to be redated now.
That's out already out on video on demand.
Unhinged?
I thought it was. Oh, okay. I'm thinking of that other movie. I'm sorry. I beg your pardon.
Mm-hmm. No. And so it was supposed to be the first big release from Solstice Studios and the first big release after the pandemic closed.
Semi-big.
Well, okay. But you know what? So it opened in Germany and everybody thought, wow, okay. And it's number one in Germany. Mm-hmm. And, but they only released
it. How much did they make? Was it?
Not a lot. I mean, no. But they only released it in the dubbed version, which might be one way to prevent piracy because it's really then only good for Germany.
Oh,
there's no English language version. There's no subtitles. So
it is a $33 million movie. So there is that to be said. So, it came out on July 16th. It made a couple hundred thousand dollars. So a pretty modest take.
Yes. I'm sure the way they would cast it is, hey, it's the number one movie in Germany.
That's right. But you were a little surprised, or you thought this was big news, that CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, that's the correct way to say it, right?
Yes.
That has been canceled for when?
2021. It's usually the first or second week of January, usually like right after New Year's. Everybody in the consumer electronics space just hates the fact that they lose their entire Christmas and New Year's holiday working straight through it to get ready for the biggest trade show of their year is like right after the holiday season.
Why don't they have it in February?
I don't know. I'm sure that has been discussed. I should actually try and figure that out. I think that they just want everything to be, you know, announced in January. They know they can't cross up Sundance. They won't get enough press.
Sundance.
They won't get enough. Yeah, it's
it seems an entirely different
later.
Beast. Who cares?
I always thought.
Yeah, why would they think Sundance would suck the oxygen out of CES? I wouldn't think they'd even, you know, it's not the same reporters.
No, there's slight overlap, but not a lot.
Really? People who cover movies are going to CES? Products?
Yeah, well,
very little. You mean you're thinking from your exhibitor point of view. For the vast majority of people, there's no overlap.
No, actually, I was thinking more from the consumer point of view when I would go to these junkets and people would complain that they had to go from CES to Sundance. And I always thought, really, you cover CES? But it wasn't everybody. It was just a handful of journalists that would cover both.
So were you just surprised that this was an event in 2021 already getting canceled? Was that why you sort of went, wow, that's big news?
I thought they'd try and do it in some way, shape, or form.
But it's you can't do it except in person, right?
Yeah, because you really need to see the products. The whole thing is showing off products.
Yeah, I mean, you can have a virtual thing where you're like, look, but it's just not the same. I mean, anybody can release a video of showing their new product. So this is the inevitable. We've been saying for a while, look, we're not going to get back to normal in 2020. It's not going to happen. There's not going to be Broadway. There's not going to be most concerts, no matter if people let them happen, they're still not going to actually happen because you can't make money on Broadway. You can't make money with most typical rock concerts. You can do something in a drive-in. You can do something with massive space available. But the normal concert where everybody jams into a room and rocks out, it's not happening. Live music like that is not happening. So now we're moving into 2021. All the events in January and February are question marks. You think we're back to normal in North America? We're way behind the rest of the world. And this is just one more example of it.
So hypothetically, let's say you had tickets to The Music Man in July of 2020. Is that still going to happen?
Yeah, I think so because, you know, I do want to get political. You're going to have a new administration and you need a serious lockdown for a month or two like we did last time, but a more serious national lockdown with everybody wearing masks and a plan for what you do after you stop it in its tracks, meaning you've geared up, you've made a lot of equipment available, you got a lot of testing available, you've got all the PPE people need, and then you slowly open back up with everything in place to help make that happen. And you shut down any little area where you see a spike. And that's how you
kind of
do
like
it.
What they did in China
and Europe and yeah. Lots of it. And Canada. Canada's doing fine and their economy is going to be in better shape because of it. You want to help the economy? First, you have to stop the pandemic. And clearly that's not going to happen until we get a new administration or this administration says, all right, we got a second chance in January. Let's take it. Well, that's the coronavirus update. There is some social justice update. Like you mentioned, our friend Chris Fenton, his book, Feeding the Dragon, is out now. It comes out today. We're recording on a Tuesday because I was traveling. Thank you for waiting, Sperling. And he's quoted in the LA Times. They just call him entertainment industry veteran Chris Fenton, author of the book, Feeding the Dragon, about the relationship between U.S. studios and China. And they quote Chris as saying studios should be more careful about how they respond to Chinese restrictions. The article is about how Hollywood has been dealing with China, saying you can't have that in your movie, you can't have this in your movie, don't do this, don't do that. Tech industry has had the same issues, and suddenly it's become a hot topic because of the rising tensions between the two countries. Chris is quoted as saying, studios need to admit that there is a lot of hypocrisy going on. They need to get out of their bubble and realize that a lot of their constituents are becoming very aware of the issues in China, end quote. Now, Chris's book is a mostly happy, rosy discussion of how culture can help bridge the gap between two countries and help prevent another Cold War, and how it's good to have those lines of communication open. At the end of the book, however, he gets a little bleaker. And
wait, I haven't gotten to the end of the book. Spoiler alert.
I won't spoil it for you, but we'll be looking forward to talking about what the media coverage has been like, what they're discussing, and how that has changed over the last few years, and how the book is doing. So we hope to have him on sometime soon. So you're reading the book right now. So that's exciting. Yeah, he did a lot of sports stuff, a lot of sports promo stuff, did lots of movie stuff. It's an interesting stuff for the people in our podcast, the people who work overseas or deal with international markets. I think they'd find a lot of interesting nuggets to pull out of that.
Well, and we were, and there's some really great anecdotes in there as mm-hmm. well. Some, you know, just some really great anecdotes. One about Nirvana, which I won't go into because that'll spoil it. But, we were at William Morris at the same time, literally the exact same time.
That's right.
And
where's your book?
I didn't go to China. So I didn't, my pen broke. The dog ate my homework.
Well, you know, some other some social justice stuff. ABC's top news exec, Barbara Fedida, has been dumped by the network. They did an internal investigation and they discovered she did say and do terrible things, but we, ABC, did nothing wrong. So she is terrible. She's been doing it for years, but we are completely innocent in all of this. She did make, quote, racially insensitive comments, end quote, and managed in a rough manner, which I would say is also known as the way every male exec ever has behaved. That's actually not fair to male execs, but I often think there's a double standard for women. She managed in a rough manner. Uh-huh. Anyway, so that's interesting news. So is the fact that the Hearst magazine company, has dumped Troy Young, the head of its magazine division. They do more than magazines. He's the head of the magazine division. The New York Times had reported a long, well-known history of lewd, sexist comments by Troy Young at the workplace. He had emailed porn to a senior editor, made explicit remarks to a junior employee, and made jokes about sex toys. Hilarious.
And his comeback was, you know, hey, the Times piece, it went a little overboard. That not all of that stuff is accurate. But I have to, you know, I take this seriously and I'm going to examine. The second he started that, I was like, dude, just resign because you're not, you can't, the second you started to say, this is a learning, you're done. Right. You are done.
Well, the funny thing is he oversaw Cosmo, Vogue, Teen Vogue, and the like.
Vogue is a Condé Nast.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm really?
You mean Cosmopolitan.
No, I know it meant Cosmopolitan, but I thought he also did Vogue.
Vogue is definitely a Condé Nast.
All right, I beg your pardon. I apologize for that. But he oversees Cosmo and other magazines that are geared towards women. Magazines that empower women are meant to give a positive message to them. And the person in charge is a man who's treating everybody, including women, like dirt. How ironic can it get? So that's a shame to see. But it is nice to see the Emmy nominations. For all the craziness, we're able to watch television, we're able to stream, and some things keep going. There may not be an Emmy Awards with everybody crowded into a room, but we can get the Emmy nominations and say, oh, my show wasn't nominated, or my show was nominated, or that actor was not nominated, or why was that actor nominated? It never gets old.
You know what, though? Here's my question. Why didn't you just say that the reason we delayed until recording until Tuesday was so that we could wait until the Emmy nominations? You were like, I went to a wedding, and was traveling, and I couldn't do it. And I was like, I would have just said, no, we were waiting for the Emmy nominations. Because, by the way, I don't think we intentionally planned that, but hey, it worked out anyway.
That's right. So that was a good idea, and I'm glad we did wait until the Emmy nominations, because we get to be blown over by the fact that The Mandalorian from Disney Plus is up for Best Drama. Have you seen The Mandalorian?
I now have Disney Plus. Thank you, Hamilton. So I will be watching The Mandalorian soon.
So you can be surprised after you watch the show. Then you go, really? Best Drama? That?
Yeah.
It's an okay show. It got a little better towards the end. It's better than the last movie, but no. However, it does show Disney Plus, the first streaming service, or one of the first, to enter the big races right off the bat. Apple TV got some nominations, but it didn't get a Best Drama or Comedy nomination, I don't believe. Disney Plus did with The Mandalorian. It got 15 nominations for that show alone. Lots of well-deserved tech nominations. There is some good stuff in that show.
Did you see Little Fires Everywhere? Because that was nominated for Best Limited Series. I read the book, liked the book.
I haven't watched it on Hulu yet. It's Hulu, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. It is on Hulu. Yeah,
so it's available. No, I have Hulu. I have not watched it yet. So that's, again, another streaming service. Apple TV, they're in the running, sort of, thanks to the morning show Quibi. Quibi had 10 nominations. How the heck did they manage that? And holy I didn't curse there. Holy Pop TV had 16 nominations, led by the series finale of Schitt's Creek. Amazon and Hulu are also in the mix.
So you were saying the last name, Schitt's.
That's right. That's right. So it's all adorable. Kids, you can say it all you want. Actually, my mom and I listened to an audiobook set in Ireland, and now she's debating whether she's willing to say the word shite.
What about feckin'?
Well, that's fine. That's feckin' is just rich and feckin'. You mean feckin'? Oh, I thought you meant feckin' like FECUND. No, she won't say feckin'. That's too close.
Okay.
What else stuck out for you?
You know what? What stuck out the whole time I'm listening to all these is how are they going to do this year? How is there going to be a television show? How are they going to like hand these awards?
Maybe they'll do it the way they always should have, which is to focus on the shows. If you watch the Emmys, you should walk away and go, wow, I want to watch Succession, or wow, I want to check out Ozark, or wow, I want to check out The Good Place, or something like that. And this is their chance to actually highlight the clips and to highlight the shows and present them to people, let them know what these shows are about, give them a sense of their flavor, and make people watch the Emmys and go, I'm going to start watching that show. Not because it just won, but because they saw a great clip from it and said, wow, that looks good. That's not what happens on the Emmys. Normally, just as with the Oscars, you can watch the entire show and not have a single idea what the top nominees are about. Or just the vaguest idea. You should walk away going, wow, I want to see that. Huh?
Who do you think wins these? I think it's going to be Succession. And I think it's... No? Oh, really? What? You think what? Killing Eve or...
Well, with Game of Thrones gone, the only repeat winner in drama is The Handmaid's Tale. So if you were going to be boring, you might think they would do that. I'm sure you and I would say, well, that just seems like yesterday's news and it didn't get great reviews that season. I think like you, it could be The Crown as sort of a boring whatever, but I think the critics would think it comes down to Succession and Better Call Saul. That's not ending
year.
But it's the second to last season. It got great reviews. If the critics picked it, it would be one of those two shows. I think you're right that Succession maybe has a little extra buzz, but never underestimate an Emmy voter for knee jerk. Oh yeah, The Handmaid's Tale. That won before. Let's do it again.
I think it's going to be in Best Comedy Series. I think it will be Insecure.
Okay. Why is that?
It's just, it's gotten great reviews. I wish I could say that I'd watched more of it. I wish I could say I'd watched more of Curb Your Enthusiasm and Dead to Me and The Marvelous Miss. I haven't even finished the latest season of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Good heavens, man. Get on the ball. Well, I will tell you, I do like Issa Rae, but there's only one nominee among the best comedy series. They've 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 shows are nominated this year. Curb Your Enthusiasm, Dead to Me, The Good Place, Insecure, The Kominsky Method, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Schitt's Creek, yes, kids, you can say that, and What We Do in the Shadows. But only one of them has won before, and that is The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. So if you want to be bored by the Emmys, you can never underestimate it. Hey, it won before, it could win again. So you might just want to go with that one. However, The Good Place and Schitt's Creek both have the glow of, you know, their final season.
Yeah.
That can help you pull it out. However, Kristen Bell did not get a nomination for The Good Place. So that's a very bad sign. I don't know why the heck she didn't get a nomination. I mean, that's just bizarre to me. But so I think that indicates a weakness in that show. Ted Danson.
I wonder if when she found that out, she went, oh, fudgesicles.
Exactly. However,
you got to watch the show to get that joke.
I was really glad that William Jackson Harper got a nomination as a best supporting actor, but bummed that Kristen Bell did not. So that might indicate The Good Place is not going to pull it off, even though it did finally get a nomination. It's probably lucky to get there. Schitt's Creek got a lot of them. That has all the momentum in the world. You're right about Insecure, but I think that's overthinking it. I don't think it has enough depth in its nominations to show that it's really one. After Watchmen, which is the most nominated show this year, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is the second most nominated show of all events that happened on TV this year. The most nominations, it's a previous winner. I predict The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel does it for the third time. I think it's won twice before.
No. I think it would be the second time.
Oh, the second time. That's right. It lost to
Game of Thrones.
Comedy. It's a comedy series.
Really?
It's The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is under Best Comedy.
What did it lose to?
It lost to not Veep, but something else like that. Maybe it was Veep last year.
Yeah, maybe.
Oh, bloody hell. Well, you'll have to look that up while we're talking. So we did mention one thing, HBO's Watchmen. It's the most nominated show this year, 26 nominations. However, Netflix is the most nominated outlet with an overwhelming 160 nominations. It had nominees in almost every major category that you can think of. HBO is number two with 107 nominations. This is only the second time in 21 years that HBO hasn't had the most nominations. That's an amazing run for HBO. It's an amazing accomplishment for Netflix in third. All right, Netflix had 160, HBO 107. In third place is NBC with 47. All the major networks combined had fewer nominations than Netflix, thanks to The Crown, Ozark, Stranger Things, Dead to Me, The Politician. This nominations in 10 of 11 major categories, the second most nominated series overall. You know, you make a lot of shows, a lot of good shows that people like. That's what's happening. And again, you look at Best Drama and Best Comedy. We named some of the best dramas: Better Call Saul, The Crown, The Handmaid's Tale, Killing Eve, The Mandalorian, Ozark, Stranger Things, and Succession. None of them on a major network. In Best Comedy Series, only one, NBC's The Good Place, is on a major network. In fact, you look at Best Limited Series, none of them are from a major network. So I think the era, you know, it's done. We're over. Streaming is completely there. Networks are barely playing this game anymore. It's all about streamers.
And Fleabag? Would it have been Fleabag?
That's it. Fleabag won last year. Fleabag won last year, and I think a few years before that was Veep ending up. So Maisel won.
Veep won in 2015, 2016, 2017.
And who won in 2018? Maisel?
Maisel.
And then 2019 was Fleabag. Yeah. And 2021, if that's how you're counting it, this year it will be, well, it can't be right, right? 2018, 20, and then 2020 will be Marvelous Mrs. Maisel again, I bet.
And then a Modern Family won every year before that.
Yeah, no. And who's going to win Best Limited Series? Slam dunk. Say it.
Little Fires Everywhere? Watchmen.
Watchmen. Yeah. In fact, our in-house TV and film critic, Aaron Rich, says Watchmen should win everything it's nominated for. In fact, it should win for stuff it's not nominated for. That's how.
Am I going to have to watch this? Because I heard like mixed things about it. Gosh,
I've heard
it.
I've heard only good things. And I've also heard only good things from Alan Menken, the composer. He is now an EGOT, thanks to the recent daytime Emmys.
I think they have a pill for that now, by the way.
Oh, that's nice.
Did you get the EGOT? Yeah.
Yes. If you watch a lot of daytime TV, they often have medication like cilantro or whatever, you know, and they always say, don't take cilantro if you're allergic to cilantro. It's like, well, okay, yes, that makes sense. But for some legal reason, they have to say, if you're allergic to our product, don't take it. You'd think that would be a given. So Alan...
Side effects for cilantro are everything.
Yeah. Alan Menken is now an EGOT. He won an Emmy, a daytime Emmy, for a song he composed for the TV series Tangled. A very good Disney film, by the way. Certainly one of the better ones in recent years from them. That joins his 8 Oscars that he won for movies like The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and Aladdin. His Tony for Newsies, and 11 Grammys, including a win for Best Cast Album for Little Shop of Horrors. Now, under Oscars, only Alfred Newman has more Oscar wins in music categories. Alan Menken has 8. Alfred Newman won 9 Oscars in music categories. And
you
of
mean
course,
like if we went over to Alan Menken's house, like on his mantle, there'd be 8 Oscars?
That's right. Well, I mean, he's
going
to need
to... So if we took one, would he notice?
Probably not. 11 Grammy, you'd be better off grabbing a Grammy, though. 11 of them. And it's very impressive because they're all in different categories for different stuff. It's not just like he did The Little Mermaid and it won Best Grammy for Best Album, Soundtrack, and a Song. You know, no, he won all over the place for lots of different projects. That to me makes this very impressive. Yes, it's a daytime Emmy, not a primetime Emmy. So the heck what? If there's no asterisk by that. He's an EGOT.
Couldn't we just grab one of each?
Sure.
Like one Grammy, one, you know?
I know.
And the salt shaker, you
and
know?
Then
why not?
And then run. You know, if we get arrested for stealing one of his awards, that will be a big deal.
Well, it certainly would be, it would make a headline. And you know what happens with headlines? We often like comb through them, right? And we try and bring some of the ones we think are big deals to our segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, because Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment. And we tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Now, our first story, Tim Ingham of Music Business Worldwide, great website. He continues to offer smart analysis of the music business all over the world. One might even say, you know, worldwide. And what is the big driver of music around the world these days? You might assume it's superstars like Taylor Swift and Ed Sheeran, but not so fast, says Ingham. In a new post carried on his website and in Rolling Stone magazine, Ingham highlights an interesting stat. Universal Music Group, UMG, they revealed that about 60% of their revenue comes from inverted commas, local acts. That means the majority of money pouring in comes from the artists that people in France and India and Brazil are digging these days, not necessarily the BTSs of the world. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal because it shows where you should be investing your money. Now, of course, 40% of your revenue does come from world-beating superstars like Taylor Swift and Ed Sheeran and people like that. But they're making a lot of money from local acts. And that means you don't need to find someone who's going to jump from Mexico to France or Mexico to the US or Mexico to Germany. They can be a superstar act and make you a lot of money in their territory. So it's a great sign. I think it's healthy for the business. More diverse music all over the world. We love to see movies being made in France and Germany and Australia and Japan and Korea that work and click. Some of them will go worldwide, but they don't have to. But it's good for the industry because all that talent matters. That's why in Sweden, you've got pop superstars created out of Sweden's, you know, hit factory. All those writers and producers, they're making acts big all over the world. So it's great to see local talent thriving locally. I bet that's true for all the other labels all around the world, and it's good to see.
Well, this next story is the reason that I'm going to have to watch all those Emmy-nominated HBO series within the next 3 days, because AT&T has something to call home about. The conglomerate says HBO Max had a great launch. In the U.S., both HBO and HBO Max boast a combined 36.3 million subscribers, a 5% increase since the year began. Of course, another way to put that is to note that the launch of HBO Max increased subscribers in the U.S. by just 1.7 million people in its first 6 months. So there's that. Now, I guess the question is that a lot of people? Is 1.7 million people a lot? Should HBO be focusing on U.S. figures or start talking about worldwide figures? Or will they only start doing that when U.S. figures plateau?
Netflix.
Yeah. And, well, I'm sure Disney Plus will go the same way. Hey, listen, is any of this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I mean, in earnings call, they say HBO Max attracted 4.1 million total subscribers, HBO Max alone. But that includes about a million people giving it for free when purchasing an AT&T wireless package. That also doesn't take into account those who cut the cord on their basic cable service. And so they don't get HBO anymore because they got rid of their cable, but now they're getting HBO Max over the top. So add it all up, and it looks to me like they added about 1.7 million people overall, because in a way, they don't care if it comes from HBO Max versus cable. But wait, they do care, don't they, Sperling? They'd rather have that fee go to them directly than go through their cable provider. Isn't that true?
That is true. And in fact, you know what? Here is the thing with HBO Max. Mm-hmm. They are not available on Amazon Fire TV.
Or Roku.
Or Roku, because they, I guess those, you know, Roku and Amazon Fire, they want a piece of the action. They want a piece of that subscription. And they're saying, look, if we wanted that, you know what? We'd stick with this thing called cable. We wouldn't be worried about streaming. So we're not doing that. And so, for instance, I have a Roku. I have a TV that is effectively in 2017.
Out of date.
Bought in 2017. Out of date today. So that should tell you, you know, they're going to have to figure something out, because...
Well, they want to make a deal with Roku and Amazon. They've wanted to for a while. So they will get there. Roku and Amazon are getting complaints from their customers saying, I want my HBO Max. You're pissing me off. As long as you call them and let them know, they'll feel that pressure. However, there's other pressure coming for basic cable services like Comcast and folks like that. Pluto TV launches this week. Peacock launched last week or 13 days ago, 2 weeks ago. I got Peacock because my brother wanted to watch the first few seasons of Yellowstone. I thought I could watch them with ads, but no, they know everyone wants to watch Yellowstone. So we had to pay $5 a month. So we could access it with ads. So once that's done, we'll probably go back to the basic free ad supported TV, or FAST. That's what Peacock is known as. It's like NBC. You can watch it. It's free, depending on how you get it, and you got to watch some ads, but not that many ads, I'll tell you. It's a better experience than watching it on prime time.
Who came up with that FAST, free advertising-supported television?
I don't know, but it must have been in one of the trades. That's where I saw it. So I think HBO Max is going to be the death knell of HBO. They want that money to come right to them. Why be carried by Comcast when people can get it directly via their streaming service and their smart TV, and you can get all the money yourself? I think eventually you're just going to say, screw you, we're going solo.
Right, and that's going to wind up being another Paramount decree waiting to happen. And yes, I got 25 cents for saying Paramount
well
decree.
Well done.
Yeah, and I don't mean the Paramount decree per se, but another type of ruling coming down.
And you can mention Paramount decree, ching, again later in the show when we get to Olivia de Havilland.
Oh, good point. The British music magazine Q is shutting down. After a 34-year run, the monthly devoted to all things popular music will be no more. It's hard to say what Q in particular offered, but it was a consumer-friendly, smart magazine devoted to countless cover stories, rehashing classics by the Beatles and Bowie and the like, while stoking attention for new artists, or new at the time at least, like, you know, Blur and Oasis, who were new at the time but then became big, and then you get the drift.
Keep going.
Its editor said the coronavirus made the magazine's fate inevitable, but it's been facing a tough go of it for quite a while. You know what I would say made the magazine's fate inevitable? This little thing called the World Wide Web. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, that's right. I mean, they said the World Wide Web and the internet was hurting them, and then the coronavirus was the death knell. I read Q magazine a lot over the years. It was, I think, one of the better British music magazines. It was not all hype all the time. They would all, half their cover stories would be veteran acts, and I'd get sucked in again. Oh, there's a 14-page breakdown of Revolver by the Beatles. Okay, I'm in. Yeah, I just couldn't help it. But they had a voluminous review section. They just covered so much music, and they had good taste. When they said something was 4 or 5 stars, it was probably worth checking out. I loved it. I watched it, read it a lot, and I'm going to miss it.
Do they have a website?
It's dead. It's not happening. Everything's gone.
Okay, well, maybe one reason Q is out of business is because people aren't discovering new acts thanks to journalists and critics in music magazines anymore. They're finding them via algorithms on YouTube and Instagram and TikTok. That explains why tension was rising between TikTok and major music publishers. It was making tons of money thanks to quick bite videos featuring snippets of music, but it was claiming fair use and not paying for all that music. Hey, you know what? The videos were created by fans, not them, right? I mean, you know, and who could argue that a 15-second clip wasn't fair use? Well, all the big players in music publishing could, and guess what they did? After threats of a lawsuit, talks began, and now TikTok and the NMPA, or the National Music Publishers Association, have signed a deal. We're full of acronyms today. The NMPA reps the three major music publishers and the world's biggest indies, and everyone is making nice. TikTok will pay an undisclosed fee for past usage of music, continue with payments going forward, and publishers can opt in as they choose the deal. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, well, the answer to that question is QED. It's quite easily done. It's a big deal. I think it's an inevitable. Absolutely. TikTok had to make peace with them. They were going to face a lawsuit. They were going to pay a lot more money if they didn't settle now. It was the right thing to do. It may have been technically fair use, but they were making too much money and playing too much music in too many ways not to recognize that they needed to make nice with the people providing the content that helped their entire damn website work.
Now, I think you were the one that introduced me to Rick Beato.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken. And he did he is a music producer and he runs a very popular.
Oh, YouTube. Yeah.
YouTube channel called Everything Music. And this guy breaks down songs and explains why they work from a music theory standpoint. And he is very good at it. And he plays all sorts of instruments and he records in his studio.
It's good for regular folk because I don't know anything about, you know,
music. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, look, yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things where you're like, well, I'll watch the first 5 minutes. And then like 2 hours later, you realize you've watched 15 videos. But that said, he did recently, a week ago, he did the top 20 greatest debut albums of all time. And in it, I guess he played 9 seconds of Creedence Clearwater Revival, an act he worked with.
Oh, my God. And that is fair use. There's no way 9 seconds of a song. It may have been a 2.5-minute song, but 9 seconds, you're okay.
And his music publisher took down the video or you know, demonetized it and said, you can't monetize this because that's our music. And it was the music publisher, and he then did a video, a 21-minute video about that and about how he emailed them and called them and said, look, what are you doing? It's 9 seconds.
This is, and it's like, just an algorithm that caught it and said, oh, they're using our music. Let's take it down.
And then they had, you know, they did it by hand. And then he even cut to Don Henley of the Eagles, who just that week was testifying before Congress via video. Don't worry, it's social distancing. Mm-hmm. And he said that, you know, the Universal Music Group is constantly trolling the internet and they said how many hours of Eagles music was on YouTube. They couldn't possibly go over all of it. There's just no way. And they had 60 people. The Eagles had hired 60 people just to keep up with this. And that's when Rick Beato went off and he was like, 60 people. One act has 60 people trolling the internet, trolling YouTube to take down music.
One very big act.
Yeah, true.
Well, I got my first takedown notice ever from, I use Libsyn. I don't know if that's Libsyn to host my podcast, my personal stuff. I had an old radio show. And frankly, when the radio show went out, it was covered by all the proper licenses. My archiving of those shows are not. So I do have complete songs on there. However, in terms of, you know, nobody's listening to my 2-hour podcast from a 4-year-old radio show in which I front and back end and introduce the songs and try to introduce people to music and get them excited by it. Nobody's being hurt by that economically. So I feel good in a ethical sense, but it is not fair use because I'm using entire songs and I personally don't have a license. When they were aired and when they're archived by that radio station, a public access radio station, they were covered. But because I'm archiving them, they are not covered. And I got my first takedown notice. They finally noticed that one of them is up there. It says, hey, this is to inform you received a DMCA takedown notice for a file hosted by your account. See below. And I got a takedown notice for an episode, Radio Shows Colors Part 1. I had a whole episode, a couple hours devoted to Colors. And the song I included that they caught, Cream by Wu-Tang Clan. Wu-Tang is like, Michael, take that beep down. Stop that beep. You know that isn't beep. Fair use.
And what did they say when you played Purple Rain?
Yeah, they did. So yeah, I'm sure I did. So yeah, I did not. I'm not messing around with Wu-Tang. I'm taking it down. It was taken down for me. So I'm surprised all the others didn't get out. So for all the fact that all this stuff is out there and it gets caught, the fact that I get zero plays, that almost nobody listens to my old crappy radio shows, is probably why it went under the radar. Whereas his stuff, very popular, gets a lot of hits, and that would, I'm sure, push it up and make it more likely to be vetted.
Yes, I agree. Mm-hmm. Well, now, it ain't easy being a worldwide company. Okay, like TikTok is a worldwide company.
Yep.
Actions that can earn you cheers in one country get you booed in another. Case in point, Netflix. The company was funding an original drama in Turkey, one of the countless positive examples of local content it's delivering all over the world. The problem, you may ask? The show was called If Only. And everything would have been if only the show didn't include a gay character. The right-wing Turkish government, which we all know it's right-wing, we all know it's populist, demanded the queer content be cut. Instead of agreeing, Netflix simply pulled the plug on the new series. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. Chris Fenton could talk about this as well. This is the problem that you have all over the world. What do you do when different countries, I mean, they're creating this content for Turkey and the government, which is becoming very fascistic, said, none of that. So there's no good answer here. I don't like the answer that they gave, which is that never mind, we'll just pull the whole show. That seems a really unhappy resolution to this. They were going to create a show. Hopefully it was going to be good. It was going to reflect the world of Turkey today.
There's something else going on there. There's something
No, there's
else
not.
There.
They're like, no, they're saying it's not worth the fuss.
Well, that too.
Yeah, there's right. Like, never mind, we're not worth the fuss. This isn't the hill we want to die on. And we're making 10 gazillion shows. We'll make something else. So that's not the right answer, but I don't know what the answer is.
Well, the top two spots on Billboard's top albums chart are sadly posthumous. Juice WRLD is at number one for the second week in a row, and Pop Smoke is it number two. Coming back from the dead are the Dixie Chicks, or the Chicks, you know, and they're now known as the Chicks. They're at number three with their new breakup album, Gaslight. Or is it Gaslighter?
Gaslighter. Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That, by the way, you want to talk about somebody that done knows Chicks wrong. I listened to that album. Oh my God, every single song is about how they're coming after you. You did done them wrong.
You're always scared by strong women, Sperling. Keep going
unbelievable.
On.
Unbelievable. I was like, man, remind me not to dump a Dixie chick because they're just, or a chick or whatever. You know what I'm talking about.
Treat women with respect. Try that.
Yes. Well, okay, fine. Well, listen, this will all change soon when Taylor Swift's critically acclaimed album Folklore hits the charts since it sold more than 1 million copies in the first 24 hours. And we mean that literally. She's kicking it old school. She's actually selling albums. On the song charts, DaBaby continues the trend of long-running number ones by staying on top for 7 weeks. But the big news is Drake. With two new top 10 hits, Drake breaks his tie with, drum roll please, Madonna at 38 and stands alone with 40 top 10 hits on the modern Billboard Hot 100. I felt like I had to say that in the voice of Casey Kasem. He also,
keep your feet on the ground and reach for the stars.
Yeah, he has the most charted songs on the Hot 100 with 224 and counting. Drake began charting in 2009. Madonna's reign in the top 10 lasted from 1983 to 2012, though she's still active and might just tell him, bitch, I'm Madonna, and score some more hits. And by the way, that might be her song.
That is a song. Yeah.
Is all this a big deal or a big whoop?
Man, we're going to get an advisory warning on our show, aren't we?
I know. Well, between Schitt's Creek
and Bitch, I'm Madonna, we're going to be in trouble. Yeah. This is a sort of a big deal slash big whoop. It's a big whoop because the whole industry game has changed. He releases an album, and the way they do the charts now, there are 20 tracks on the album, and they all hit the Hot 100. That would never have happened before. The Beatles did have, the top five on the Hot 100 at one point. That was an amazing, every single song in the top five was by the Beatles. That was a true indication of overwhelming worldwide domination and how much people were loving and listening to that music. Drake can get powered onto the charts simply by all his fans listening to the music at the same time. So Madonna's accomplishment is from a different era. It truly is.
Drake's trying to compare them is almost impossible. Right.
Drake's accomplishment is great. And this is another reason why you need to change the album charts, dump sales, just focus on streaming because that's where all the action is. Give us a chart showing us, look, stop trying to convert streaming into sales. It doesn't work. So I'm glad to see Juice WRLD on there. I got to check that album out. Happy for the dick for the chicks. Going to listen to Gaslight or haven't done that yet because I've been on the road for 10 days. Taylor Swift, got to check that out. Drake, he's doing the 2C slide and it's working. But this next one, Sperling, this one is for you. Actor Henry Golding exploded into leading man status with the worldwide smash hit Crazy Rich Asians. He proved that was no fluke with solid turns in Guy Ritchie's The Gentleman, A Simple Favor, and the romantic comedy Last Christmas. Romantic drama, I should say. All of them were modestly budgeted smash hits, with Last Christmas in particular minting him as a heartthrob. Upcoming films include the G.I. Joe franchise flick Snake Eyes and sequels to Crazy Rich Asians. Now, after leaping into the role of a leading man, Golding is leaping from Paradigm to CAA. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? More importantly, why now? This drives me nuts.
Yeah, it was like this kind of thing. By the way, this story, pretty much the definition of a big whoop. Okay.
right. Actor switches agent.
Actor switches agent.
The ghost of Karen Woodward has come back to haunt us.
Yes. Now, however, I always think, Ben Stiller was the first person where I was working for an agent at the time, and Ben Stiller had directed The Cable Guy and had switched agents from, I think it was CAA, to UTA, where he was going to be represented by Jim Carrey's agent. And the agent that worked next to the agent of Ben Stiller said, I can't believe Ben Stiller is leaving for UTA. Ben Stiller's whole career is a miracle of modern agenting. That comment. Now, this was very early on in Ben Stiller's career, very early on. And since then, I'm sure that is not actually the case. But that said, Henry Golding's career is kind of
I don't think so. I think he's on fire. I'm just wondering why he suddenly thinks Paradigm's not getting the job done. I think he's an absolute talent. I think he's extremely magnetic, extremely charming. I don't think he's a fluke or like, how did that guy become successful? No, my question is why, when everything is working for him, is he suddenly saying, I'm switching agents? People do this all the time and it drives me nuts. Maybe Paradigm is not making the projects happen that he expects to happen. Maybe he feels like there's all these opportunities and they're dropping the ball. I don't know, of course, the inside story, but whenever someone is really succeeding well and they've just exploded onto the scene, to dump your agent right then, to me, is like, really? They got you here and now you're going to walk away from them?
That happens all the time.
I know, and I don't like it.
I'll never forget being in the Ryan Phillippe when he was really hot.
Mm-hmm. And he kind of still is. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But you know what I mean?
I know. I'm kidding.
And all these
kidding.
Big movies, very young.
Yep. Yep.
He was represented by someone at Don Buchwald and Associates. And I just knew at the time, everybody knew, like at some point the fax is coming in. And I literally mean the fax, FAX.
Yeah.
And one Friday that fax rang and the agent wasn't there. And the poor assistant that had to call and say, listen, we received a fax and your biggest client, the one,
But the Paradigm is not that tiny of an agency
it's not.
Right. That's what I understand. I don't like it, but I understand if you're at a really small place and you feel like the game has changed and they just can't handle the demands that you face. But Paradigm to CAA, that to me, I don't like that one. So if you know a secret, you want to tell us the inside scoop on Paradigm to CAA for Henry Golding, let us know.
Yes, you can reach us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number...
Where are you?
I... Can, Sorry, I went to Variety to see what who is agent who
multitasking. Multitasking.
I was multitasking, but I had pulled up that tab ages ago, and now all of a sudden the autoplay of all those videos that they have on Variety.
I hate autoplay. I hate it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, you can call us and actually complain about autoplay yourself. 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. Or we're on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. And I'm trying to figure out here, there was a comment left and I can't figure out. It says also Roof's client. I don't know what that means.
Where is this?
I guess on the... on, I guess Nick LaPiccolo.
Focus.
No.
What are you looking at?
I'm looking at the Variety article announcing the move of, and he was a banner client for Paradigm's Nick LaPiccolo. He broke out as the, and so I don't know why he would leave either, unless Nick LaPiccolo left or maybe he just couldn't get certain roles. I don't know.
Well, here's one final big deal or big whoops, Berlin. You tell me this. The news just broke. CAA is firing or furloughing about 400 staffers across the board. As many as 100 agents and 300 support staff are facing pink slips or reduced hours in numerous departments at the agency and across all their offices, LA, Nashville, New York, and London, according to multiple sources with knowledge of the situation. That's in Variety and all the other trades. Variety
is a big
report. That's very sad to hear.
And they're probably junior agents that don't have big clients. And so once you fire, let's say you fire 100 agents, you're also firing their support staff. So that's 200 right there. And, you know, or maybe, you know, 150, 175. But there's usually, you know, support staff. Yeah, the person who has, you know, Fred Spector used to have two, three assistants. Right now, you don't need three assistants. You're not setting up appointments. All appointments are canceled. So your appointment setter is gone. And this is dragging on far longer than anybody thought.
Yeah, so this is, it's not going away anytime soon. So Issa Rae did get a nomination for Best Actress for a comedy series, though her co-star did not in that show. And that female friendship is sort of the heart of Insecure. And that's the focus of a Variety article I just saw. Why Insecure is the most exciting Emmy comedy nomination or Emmy comedy nominee. You can check that on Variety, but I don't think that means it's going to win. That just means it's got that hip factor to it, but I don't think that's enough. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop and takes us to Inside Baseball. That's where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This began with a story in the UK, and it applies to the US as well. It's quick. It's sharp. It's to the point, and there's some good news at the end. First of all, a cultural committee in the UK has criticized their government for its response to the art world. They say the UK may become a cultural wasteland, and everything they say about
this is not the first time we've talked about the UK and
and it applies to everybody. It applies to the US theater world and the French and Australian and everybody. Yeah. So they say, by the way, more people go to the theater each year in the UK than attend a soccer match. Yet the UK
is that true?
Of course, it's true. And yet the UK government, you look at Broadway and what they do compared to attendance at
MLS.
All sports combined in New York City. All sports combined: football, basketball, baseball, hockey, MLS. All of it combined does not match how many people go to a Broadway show. Yet, and there's good reasons for that. They have 8 shows a week on Broadway, and they have a lot of games, but not quite as many. Yet the UK government, despite the fact that a lot more people go to the theater than attend a soccer match, they went whole hog to map out a strategy for soccer, but have done little or nothing for theater, whose reopening plans remain vague and confusing. They say 70% of theaters and production companies that create theater may close permanently by the end of the year. Looking at music, per the Music Venues Trust, they say 93% of all music venues may shutter for good. Now, we can compare that to AMC, the movie chain here in the US. They may go bankrupt. Someone else may very well pick them up. They're probably not going to disappear off the face of the earth. Those can't be repurposed. So music venues, some of them may disappear forever. Others will just get picked up by someone new, we hope. But that's a big threat to a big infrastructure and a big industry. They point out the hundreds of thousands of people directly employed by the entertainment industry, and the millions of jobs and the tons of money that gets generated by that industry. And in the UK, especially, the arts really punches above its weight. They really deliver to that country far beyond their numbers or the size of the country. Now, in the UK, there was a recent infusion of cash, and this culture committee says that's a good first step, but it cannot be the last. Similarly, UK film and TV producers came forward and they said, we are going to lose $1 billion+ in productions for TV and film if the government doesn't provide COVID insurance. That hasn't happened yet in the US. I think in most countries around the world, it hasn't happened. But after they came out and said that, yesterday or today, the government has stepped forward. They have approved $650 million in COVID insurance fund. So they are going to have a fund. They're going to start funding and backing and insuring productions so that they can go back to filming movies and TV shows and be able to get the insurance they need. Because all these people say, hey, look, we want to start filming again, but if our lead actor gets sick, we're going to have to shut down for 14 days and no one is going to provide us the insurance to cover that. The government has to step in. So that's what's happened in the UK. The government has stepped forward. I don't know if it's enough, but they have stepped forward with a big fund of $650 million. They want to help get production back on board. U.S. productions and productions all over the world face these same challenges. Nothing is happening yet. And unless they step in to prop up the theater business and the arts business, we're going to lose a lot of talent and people that cannot be replaced.
The big thing that you mentioned there is insurance, and this is a big, big problem. Studios are what they refer to as self-insuring. They're just insuring themselves. Literally, they are insuring themselves. And banks are willing to give the loan, the production loan, because they know if everything goes south, the studio will come in and they have assets. Right. Whereas a lot of these independent, all the independent productions, which is most of the UK, they don't have that luxury. And even, you know, like the Lionsgates of the world, the Solstice Studios, they don't have the luxury of insuring themselves. And so you need production insurance. Now, most production insurance will say, yeah, here it is. Oh, by the way, there's this little clause there that says that COVID isn't covered.
Yep.
So it's a bit of an issue, and it's something that has been brought up time and time again by independent producers over the last 4 months. And now it's really coming home because people are trying to figure out ways to start production again, and there's just no way to do it without the insurance, because there's no way to get a loan without having the insurance.
Yeah.
So
they've got to step forward.
It's a problem.
You think,
and by the way, you're talking about the UK, right?
Yeah.
What about the US? NATO, the National Association of Theater Owners, has a big campaign, Save Your Cinema, trying to push people to write to Congress to say, hey, look, give us some funds here because we're dying. We are literally dying. We will probably never reopen some of these theaters.
That's right. And you know, you think, oh, we just don't have endless money to throw at all these problems. It's a lot cheaper to keep people and the lights on in businesses. It's a lot cheaper to help them stay there until we can get back to normal than it is to let them all collapse, just like paying people's rent. You can let them not pay rent and go homeless, and then the landlord's out of money too, and they're bankrupt because, you know, they got all these properties and nobody can afford to rent it and everybody's homeless. That's a bigger problem to fix than just helping people stay in place during a pandemic. But that wraps up Big Deal, Inside Baseball, because that's a great segue into our obituary section. We're talking about all these music venues that may close down forever. In the UK, they say 93% of all music venues may shutter for good. You know what? At some point, almost all venues do shutter for good. That's the case for The Bottom Line, which is a great venue in New York City where I once saw jazz singer Annie Ross perform. She died at 89 this week, and The Bottom Line was a great venue. Springsteen had a great performance there. It was a great place. I saw a lot of acts like Loud Love It there over the years. Great, intimate, small venue where you got to see these great talents up close. I love to stand at the bar because you really got a great view. But anyway, The Bottom Line is gone, and so is jazz singer Annie Ross. She was a member of Lambert, Hendrix, and Ross. That's her claim to fame. Though she did have a solo act for decades, and she had stuff before and after that. She debuted as a child actor alongside Judy Garland in a film called Presenting Lily Mars. For about a hot minute, she was dubbed the Scottish Shirley Temple, but that went by the wayside. When I saw her at The Bottom Line, she was pushing a solo album done tied into the Robert Altman film Shortcuts, where her music was featured prominently. She also acted in that movie, I believe. She just did 7 albums with the trio, Lambert, Hendrix, and Ross, but they were hugely influential. They helped pioneer vocalese, where the vocal line follows the melody of a jazz instrumental improv. Her solo hit Twisted was covered by many, including Joni Mitchell on the classic album Court and Spark. She had a handful of brief marriages and relationships, including one with Lenny Bruce, who of course features on the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. It's all tied up together. Lenny Bruce apparently would write "I love you" to her on an airplane air sickness bag and give it to her. So he'd pick up an air sickness bag, right? "I love you," and give it to her when he got off the plane. That sounds like Lenny Bruce. But
by the way, you know, a lot of people, sorry, go ahead.
No, keep going.
You asked about the bottom line.
Yeah.
Earlier, you mentioned the bottom line.
Yeah.
Right? Where I saw Melissa Etheridge and many countless people, Buster Poindexter, mm-hmm. none of the acts that you just mentioned. But that said, you know, the Stone Pony gets a lot of credit for launching Springsteen. That is true in New Jersey. In New York, it was the bottom line.
Oh, absolutely. And they had a famous performance for Born to Run. He was on the cover of Newsweek and Time magazine at the same week. And he had a stand there that just made him a god forever. That was the show where, you know, "I've seen the future of rock and roll." I mean, that was just a great, great thing. But yeah, so Annie Ross is gone. But who else died this week, Sperling? Oh, and by the way, if you're not familiar with Lambert, Hendrix, and Ross, check out Everybody's Boppin', a terrific Columbia Jazz masterpiece collection of their greatest hits. Everybody's Boppin' by Lambert, Hendrix, and Ross.
Well, the founder of Fleetwood Mac died, Peter Green.
Yeah,
he died at the
Have you ever listened to them before the Buckingham Nicks era?
Nope.
Right. Fleetwood Mac, of course, is a huge pop rock dynasty. Some of the biggest albums of all time. You know them, you love them. Tusk, Rumors, Fleetwood Mac. That album from 73 is just a gem. I love it. It may be my favorite album by them. That's when Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks joined the band. Before that, they had an earlier incarnation where they're almost a completely different band. They're a hugely influential blues rock band. They were pioneered a sound that would be followed by countless American bands like the Allman Brothers, of all people. It was a blues rock amalgamation. Peter Green was their guitarist, one of the best guitarists of all time, according to Rolling Stone. If you just check out one album, check out Then Play On. Then Play On is a masterpiece. And when you listen to that, you go, wow, this is Fleetwood Mac? And secondly, wow, this is really good. Speaking of mental illness, like we did with Kanye West at the top of the show, Peter Green lived with schizophrenia all his life. He faced mental health issues repeatedly. He left the band in the early 70s or the late 60s, and he joined a commune. He rejected material goods, and he barely released any music, just 2 solo albums in the 70s. And then his life sort of fell apart again, and he had to struggle and deal with the mental health issues he faced all his life. The label behind Fleetwood Mac just announced a massive box set to celebrate the blues rock legacy era of Fleetwood Mac and the years of Green. And he was recently named by Rolling Stone one of the great guitarists of all time. So if you like Fleetwood Mac and you think, what's that early stuff? Or you like the Allman Brothers, they're a whole new incarnation of Fleetwood Mac that you should embrace and check out. You can start with Then Play On.
And you can start by watching actor John Saxon backwards. Watch some of the stuff he did with Tarantino.
Yeah, that's right. He was a teen idol right along Sal Mineo. Then he became a horror flick mainstay. And then he sort of got a late career cool where people were like, you know, he'd been around so long and done so much TV and movies that he got some good knowing cameos in films by Tarantino and horror flicks. And if you ever saw his picture, you'd go, oh, that guy. He had a gazillion credits. Though sad that he went from early hits and major directors like Vincent Minnelli, Mario Bava, John Huston, to stuff like Battle Beyond the Stars, My Mom's a Werewolf, and so on. But if you watched TV in the 70s and 80s, The $6 Million Man, Love Boat, a million different shows, you will recognize John Saxon for sure. He died at the age of 83. He's a journeyman actor. Seems like a good guy. But, you know, a working actor, that ain't easy, and he did it.
Now, speaking of which, if you watch TV at all, at least in the U.S., and even overseas, because, well, we'll explain, you probably would recognize Regis Philbin, who died at the age of 88. This guy was on TV more than, well, literally more than anybody.
Yeah, that's right. He just passed Hugh Downs. Hugh Downs, who died recently, had the record for more TV hours than anyone else in history until he was passed by Regis Philbin.
And Regis Philbin, of course, Regis and Kathy Lee, that was the morning show that they did. But he was also the host of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Mm-hmm. And I mean, he was always on the David Letterman show, the late show with David Letterman.
He was Letterman's number one guest. He had him on more times than anyone else. I always think of Tony Randall as a great guest. Regis, though, will always be entertaining. And he and Letterman had a great, you know, zinger relationship. They had a lot of fun. You know, hang around long enough and everyone will love you. He is irascible, irrepressible. He's just, you know, he's easy on camera, casual, easy. And that was his.
Do you ever meet him?
My mom met him. She's a tennis umpire, or was in her day. And there were one of those pro-ams in Florida where I think Chrissy Everett was hosting an event, and Regis was there. And she said, it was very nice. Just like, you know, this was many years ago in the 90s, I think. And she said, oh, you know, very, very nice guy. Very outgoing and friendly too.
Yeah, he was.
So, you know, just a great talent. You know, will we ever watch this stuff again? No, we won't. But by God, he was one of the biggest hits of all time. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? That was a phenomenon on ABC. That really was. That's in the record books. And by God, he was on TV a lot. I'll give him that.
You know, I first met him at the world premiere, or okay, the New York premiere of The Godfather Part 3 was the first time I ever met him.
Oi.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you talked to him a lot because he didn't want to watch the movie.
Yeah, no, he had a better seat than I did.
I should hope he would. Also, finally dying, this is a big one. Olivia de Havilland dies at the age of 104. She was a two-time Oscar winner. She's the last living star of Gone with the Wind, a film that she saw morph from the biggest hit of all time, probably still is by many standards, to a legendary film, to problematic. Lived just long enough to find out people are going, that movie you're so proud of, not so sure.
Right. As a matter of fact, we're taking it down.
No, we're not taking it down. We're just putting it in its context and saying, yeah, not so great. But she did win Oscars for other movies. She lost, of course, to her co-star for that movie playing Mammy. So that was Hattie McDaniel, and that was a groundbreaking win. I'm sure, given the fact that she eventually won Oscars, she was happy. That's the best thing about Gone with the Wind, that Hattie McDaniel perhaps broke that color barrier, though doing it, of course, for a role that white people would expect you to play, a sassy, adorable, enslaved person who loved being enslaved and just like a member of the family. But anyway, she eventually won her Oscars for To Each His Own from 1946 and The Heiress from 1949, which co-starred Montgomery Clift. She was the sister of Joan Fontaine, and boy, did they dislike each other. They did not get along. But the interesting thing about those two wins are that they came years after she battled and helped end the studio system. And this is why she's an important person to remember.
Yeah, she sued in 1943 to get free from Warner Brothers.
Yeah, she had a seven-year contract.
She had a seven-year contract.
And,
yeah,
but she turned down some roles and they said, oh, you won't make that role. Fine, we're suspending you. And so she had like a six-month suspension. And then when her contract was up, she's like, I'm done. And they're like, no, you owe us another 6 months. And she's like, no, I don't. Just because you suspended me, like I still only have to serve. No, they went to court and she won. It was a big, big deal. It's even called the de Havilland ruling or something like that. I mean, it was known in legal circles. Between that and one other big ruling known as
the Paramount Decree, cha-ching,
that really helped end the studio system. When she won, you know, Betty Davis tried to end her contract and lost. James Cagney tried to break his contract and lost. When she won, she got showered with thank you notes and flowers and cards and letters and phone calls from a bunch of Hollywood other stars who said, wow, now we've got a lot more power. So that was what her big accomplishment was. I frankly never paid as much attention to her acting career. She never really interested me a lot, but she did make some very good movies. She made 9 films with director Michael Curtiz, 9 films, not all of them with Curtiz, with Errol Flynn, including Captain Blood, and of course, her best film, perhaps, The Adventures of Robin Hood. That is a classic film, but also The Snake Pit. I think we mentioned Hold Back the Dawn already. Oh, no, we didn't. So Hold Back the Dawn, that's another really good film. So she does have some very good films. I think the best of all after The Adventures of Robin is probably The Heiress from 1949. That is a great film.
That's what she's known
great
for.
Great film, and it improves on the stage production. It does some things the stage play couldn't do. The ending is just chilling in that movie.
It works
really, really well. Great movie. If you've never seen that, if you've never seen that version of Robin Hood, that is the classic version, which all others are compared to and fall far, far short. Yeah, and if you like, we have a link in our show notes. Variety has a good story on her battle with the studio system.
Everybody wanted to know why Clark Gable didn't want out of his contract. And, you know, whenever somebody would ask him about that, he would say, frankly, I don't give a damn.
And I don't give a damn, but our show is over, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And that those were the closing. Well, I don't want to know. Spoiler alert, closing line of Gone with the Wind.
It's all right. It's a sled.
It's a sled.
Keep going.
Darth Vader is Luke's father.
Oh, God. Now, that's bad. That's going too far.
Too far. Well, you know what? I think we've gone too far into this episode, so probably nobody heard it. But that said, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Stitcher, Microsoft Marketplace, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Please do rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on that website, showbizsandbox.com. as well as ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter at showbizsandbox is our handle. We're on Facebook. Facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where you can like our page. Again, all that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's voteforbettercallsaul.com.
Oh, okay. That's a reference to the Emmys. You know, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that website, which may very well exist, actually, a four-year consideration website, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com? Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com until 2 weeks from now.
That's right. No show. See you, Sperling. I'm going to miss you.
Play nice.